Paul J. Williams tells a story about how he tried alcohol, pot, cocaine, and ecstasy. Each was not his thing, and he walked away. But a perfect storm presented itself the first time he used crystal meth while engaging in sex. In that moment, it calmed his shame of being gay, gay sex, being sexually abused, and his fear of being inadequate. This went on for years until the final play of the perfect storm was an attempted suicide. Clean and sober since 2015, Paul's story of what his life is like now is interesting and inspiring. I suspect many will relate to some aspects of his journey. Hello, Paul J. Williams, and welcome to the Authentic Gay Man podcast. I'm excited to have this time with you and to hear your story.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, so to let the audience know how Paul and I know each other, we met in 1991, soon to be 32 years ago. I had just moved to Dallas from Austin, and I auditioned and got into the Turtle Creek Corral. And if you've never heard of that or don't know, that is a globally recognized gay men's chorus that has been around since the baby Jesus. And what is it? Probably 35 years now, maybe?
It started in 1980 or 81. So it's been over 40 years.
It's been 40 years now. Yeah, I was only in for 3 years. But it was a magical experience, and I got to sing on 5 of the CDs and the stage at Carnegie Hall, my 15 minutes of Andy Warhol fame.
And you got to do it in New York City.
I did. What a magical trip that was. I still talk about that every once in a while. It was great. So, Paul, tell me, how would you define what it means to be an authentic gay man?
I love this word authentic, and I believe I've said to you privately before, it automatically brings to mind the book, The Velvet Rage, which was given to me many years ago and that I've highly recommended to other people. And the whole book breaks down the 3 levels of authenticity in a gay man's life. The first level of just being so completely in the closet and afraid and then the second level being out, but not being comfortable with who you are. And so you're having to hide behind money and things and whatever. And then the third level is being fully comfortable in who you are and not feeling like you have to put on a facade. So I believe that authentic can fall all along that spectrum. You are as authentic as you can be at that point in your life. But I think the ultimate goal is to be completely you without fear of who you are or anything about yourself.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I read that book some years ago, but I don't recall that with the clarity that you do. And I love those 3 levels. It's going to actually make me dig the book out. Go back through some of that, because authenticity is what my platform is completely centered around. And you know, the way you talked about number 2, being out, but not fully being comfortable with who you are. And I realized when you said that can mean that you're not comfortable with the straight world about who you are, but it can also mean that you're not comfortable with other gay people. That was my story.
Yeah. Or you're not comfortable with your station in life. And so in order to feel more accepted, you overcompensate in some way or another. You overcompensate with your how you look and you're working out. You overcompensate with things. You overcompensate with money, trying to grab the attention of others for something that you may or may not truly have, i.e., you may or may not truly be authentic. Getting to that third level is, this is me. I make X amount of money this every year, and I drive a Toyota, you know, whatever. You're authentically being yourself and not having to put on something to impress people.
Well, and that putting something on to impress people is something our community really, really suffers from in a big way, I think. That's pretty prominent out there in my experience.
Well, you know, of course, some of us really do have stuff to impress others, and we don't have to make it up.
I love it. I love it. Okay, love your definition. Thank you for that. It's been so interesting hearing all the different ways that men express that. And they're all right, you know. Every single one of them have been spot on, and yet they've been quite different.
Well, they're authentic.
Yeah, they're authentic. Exactly. So on to our big question of the hour. Paul, what is the biggest challenge that you have had to go through in this lifetime or are still continuing to go through?
It's got several layers to it, which we can get into. But I think when I look back over my life, the turning point for me was getting clean and sober. My awareness of having a substance abuse issue came to me very late in life. And getting through that and getting to know myself better and getting honest with myself has completely changed who I am for the better. So while I'd love to be able to say, you know, addiction in general, it is so much more than that, that I define as a big turning point in my life. It's getting from that place of darkness to the place of light where I am now.
Well, and you, the way you worded, you know, not really being aware that you had a substance issue until late in life, I'd love to unpack that and understand what you mean by that. Like I guess that's typical of a lot of addiction. People have a problem and they don't know they have a problem.
Well, it really was. When I was in high school, you know, I had that best little boy in the world syndrome. And I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church in San Antonio, and I had a very great nuclear family, and I wanted to be perfect. And in the 70s, when so many people I knew were smoking pot, I was horrified. How dare you do something so vile, you know? I didn't have my first alcoholic beverage until I was 18. I never drank in high school.
I didn't either. I was in college when I had my first alcohol.
College too. And, you know, I've heard people who have battled alcoholism talk about the fact that from the moment they had their first drink, they began chasing that feeling of an altered state. And that wasn't my story. I drank because it was there. I drank because my friends did. I usually only drank when someone else was paying for it because I was cheap. And there were times in my life when, yes, I got blotto drunk, but it wasn't the goal. And quite frankly, I didn't like that feeling. The next day, I always felt like I had to apologize for something. What did I say? You know? So then you move on to my early 20s. And a friend of mine said, you really should try pot. And I'm like, oh no, you know.
Not me.
Oh, heaven, I could not get my hands off my pearls. but I did. And I remember getting really giggly and hungry. And that was it. And I walked away going, well, I don't need to do that anymore, you know. At a girlfriend's 25th birthday party, I was offered cocaine. And I was like, oh, whatever. So I did it. couldn't tell much difference. Didn't, you know, I was like, okay, done that. New Year's Eve of 85 into 86. This was the big ecstasy days in Dallas. And I was upset that my friends were doing ecstasy. I don't care if it's legal or not. You're playing with your health. But I did. I took ecstasy, had a fun time. My friends referred to me as Morticia all night because I was taking these little baby steps all over the bar that night and chomping gum. Hi, 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 where are you? Hi, hi, you know. So that the next day, my muscles hurt so bad from all of that, you know, baby steps. I was like, well, I'm never doing that again. And I didn't. So see, I've got this history of saying, well, okay, if I'm going to be against something, I better try it just so I can, you know, not be a hypocrite. And I lived my life that way. And it wasn't until I was 41 years old that a substance was offered to me that I wasn't able to walk away from. And that was crystal meth. I was living in New York City, frustrated with the way my acting career was going, realizing that I was doing more for the lawyers I was working for than I was for my own career. And actually, the first time it was offered to me, I couldn't tell a difference. Story of my life. But then I decided to try it again, and it clicked. And in retrospect now, I can say that the reason that it clicked, I believe, is because this was the only drug that I tried in conjunction with sex. And I've always had crazy issues around sex. And the drug took that away. I didn't have the shame. I felt invincible. I didn't have the low self-esteem. And so it became a problem. But because of my track history with all the other substances, even when I started having physical consequences, I still didn't think I had a problem because I'll be able to walk away from this, right? So it took me 13 years of off and on usage to get to the point where I was like, I got a problem. So that was a long answer to a short question.
So by the time you realized you had a problem, you were, I'm thinking, 53, maybe?
Yeah.
Did I do the math right?
I think that's about right. Yeah. In fact, right. I was in my 50s. Well, let's put it this way. I turned 54 in rehab. So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard anybody talk about that the way you're talking about that, to try so many things and once and then just go, eh, that isn't my thing. That isn't my thing.
So I had it ingrained in my head that I don't have an addictive personality. You know, there was no addiction in my immediate family. You know, why me? And then, of course, because at that point in my life, I had developed a career as a comedian and an actor and had lived in New York and had a modicum of success. I thought, I can't go to one of those 12-step meetings. Don't they know who I am? You know, I don't want to be recognized, you know, and I don't want to appear to have a problem. Because I got to make sure everyone thinks my shit don't stink.
Yeah, we go through that, don't we?
Mm.
I certainly spent my time in that place. Yeah. You know, I think that what you're describing, Paul, is a perfect storm. I think that when you stumbled across the meth and figured out almost immediately that it could quell the shame. That was the perfect storm.
Sure.
You know, it was like for the first time in your life, you had relief from something that had plagued you your whole existence. And it makes sense that it would be like, oh, well, beam me up. Give me more of that.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I mentioned that I've always had issues around sex. Dare I say, maybe even a sex addiction. And that comes from so many different places. I mean, growing up in a good Christian home, as it were, I knew that being gay was different, but I didn't get a lot of the hellfire and brimstone that I could have gotten elsewhere. But I still wanted to keep my parents happy. So I put women on such a pedestal because I had been told, you know, no sex before marriage. What that did was it skewed my feelings about anything physical with women. Now, I can make all the excuses I want, but it all boils down to the fact that I didn't have a gut attraction, physical attraction to women like most guys my age did. I was afraid to even kiss girls because that would knock them off their pedestal and defile them. When it came to sex, I have sexual trauma from my childhood that I prefer to keep pretty private. But I will say that I have been in therapy for a long time to deal with it, and how that issue has colored my ability to deal with sex as an adult and or relationships, intimate relationships. All of that has created another perfect storm that the crystal meth calmed.
Well, and you started off saying this is in layers, and yes, it is in layers, because I mean, we have the normal amount of shame that comes along with gay sex, and then you've got childhood sexual abuse of some sort that's layered on top of that and adds another whole layer of not only trauma, but additional shame, because I've never known a survivor of sexual abuse that didn't carry a lot of shame around that. Paul, would you say that it was all about shame was the driving force? It was that calming of the shame? Or were there other emotional aspects to the use of the substances that it also calmed? And if so, what were those?
Oh, absolutely. And the first thing that comes to mind is self-esteem, self-image. I, for all of my fearlessness on stage and to be able to speak in front of crowds and perform in front of crowds and do it without fear, when it comes to how I see myself physically, my self-esteem is in the basement. And again, that probably has lots of layers to it of how it has developed to that point.
So your professional persona and your personal persona were two completely different, like actually on opposite ends of the continuum.
Right, right. And honestly, the more I learn with actors and performers, that is usually the norm. It really tied into what I saw when I looked in a mirror, what I thought of when I thought of myself as a sexual being. The tape in my head was just vitriolic. You know, you are pitiful. You are hideous. Nobody would want you. And so crystal meth, I feel pretty, you know, and I'm with other people who are in an altered state. And I don't know what demons they're battling, but the demon of the drug overtook every other demon.
Well, and you're describing something that's rather subtle, but it's worth calling out. When you were on the meth and you were in that I feel pretty state, your energy shifted. And as a result, your reality shifted in that moment because you, even if it was artificially created, if you felt pretty, you acted from that place. Your actions, your energy was from that place. And, you know, the world saw you differently in those moments were the moments when you probably were treated the prettiest by others, if I had to guess. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes. The other word that comes to mind in the midst of this altered state is the complete absence of inhibitions. They go out the window. And so that is another layer of how I feel about myself. I'm not inhibited by my past, by my upbringing, by the lies I've told myself about who I am.
Well, you know, there's a many different ways to use reasons to use alcohol or drugs. I've never been into drugs. I've smoked pot a couple of times, but I never really liked that much. But in my day, I drank my share. I was a party drinker. And for me, it was social lubricant. It wasn't numbing myself. It wasn't hiding. It wasn't escaping. It was liquid fucking courage. It was what gave me enough chutzpah to talk to that hot guy leaning against the bar over there.
And I know that is such a common story of humans, not gay men, not straight men, you know, the human, the human condition.
Yes. Yes. We call it liquid courage. I also have referred to it as social lubricant.
Yeah, absolutely. Get the wheels rolling.
Exactly. So another question popped into my mind. Let's see if I can recall it. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to recall it. You know, sometimes it's gone.
We're all here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it'll come back in a minute. So I'm trying to come up with a good question now. How did you figure this all out? What was the point when you realized, okay, I have, what was the thing that brought you to this moment of knowing, ah, fuck, I got a problem?
Okay. Great question. Let's go back a little. The first time I used meth was in November of 2002. By April 1st of 2003, I had my first hospitalization relating to the drug. And at the time, I thought it was a heart problem. It wasn't until years later that I requisitioned my records from that hospital and went through them and saw that I had been put in the psych ward and medicated because I was in psychosis. Nonetheless, when I got out, I didn't stop using, but I thought, I need to get out of New York or I'm going to die. And I guess I'll go back to Dallas, even though it's going to be with my tail between my legs, because everyone expected me to be a big success in New York. And here I am moving back, you know. And I thought, well, there's not as many drugs in Dallas as there are in New York. Oh, that was a big one, big lie.
Yeah.
So when I got back and realized, okay, I've still got a problem here.
I have a question before I forget.
Yep.
Everybody was expecting you to really make it big in New York. Now it's nearly 20 years later, and you look back on all that. And do you think that was true? Do you think everybody was expecting you to make it big, or do you think it was you that was expecting to make it big?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that when I moved to New York, I was sent off with this huge celebration at the Anatole that people organized for me. And it was a send-off. It implanted in my head that the expectation was for me to be a success. The majority of it, I'm sure, was in my head. And as I, now these 20 years later, and look back, my career is so much better here than it was in Dallas.
Well, the universe has a pretty uncanny way of putting us where we need to be sometimes.
Yeah, and I loved living in New York. I made incredible contacts, hung out with some incredibly successful people, had a blast.
Well, it's an exciting place. There's no two ways about it. It's, right. It's an energy that you can't duplicate anywhere else.
But Paul, it's easier to keep my head above water here.
Well, yes. When you came back, how did your Dallas community that sent you off, how did they receive you when you came back?
Good. I felt like a lot of the community that sent me off, I didn't actually step back into. You know, I had been Mr. Turtle Creek Corral all the way through 1997. And when I came back in 2003, I stayed away. I didn't rejoin. I began getting more involved in theater than I had before I moved to New York. So I walked into a different community. That was probably the best thing for me too, is a form of reinvention.
Well, you know, please say that again. This is one of those sentences that the listeners need to hear.
When I came back, I created a new community. I did not fall back into the same cocoon I had been in before. It was a somewhat of a form of reinvention that I find new ways to pursue success. And well, it was extraordinarily successful.
You were a different person. You weren't the same person that had left.
Right. And certainly not the person I am now, because, I mean, the very first theater show I did when I got back in 2003, I was high as fuck during most of the performances. Nobody knew, because my other actors and I have talked about it since then. But I can tell you, I was high.
So that was what enabled you to really perform?
No, because here's the truth. I hate being in an altered state when I'm trying to perform. I just don't feel any control over my talents. That was that just sense. A fact that I
that makes complete sense.
You know, over the ensuing years, I was able to dial back my usage to the point where I would use every 6 weeks, maybe, or every 3 months, or, you know, I was a binge user. I'd use on the weekends and then spend the next week trying to come down. And as is true of most people in addiction, the more you use, the less it works. And you're chasing that original high.
So you've got to up the dosage.
Bingo. And with crystal methamphetamine, I read this somewhere and it's a perfect description. When you come down, you lose the ability to experience joy because you have been flooding your brain with serotonin in an artificial manner. Your brain decides, oh, I don't need to make serotonin. You're pumping it in. Well, then you stop using, and the brain's up there going, oh, we don't need to make any serotonin. Well, you're depleted, and now you have no serotonin. And it is the worst kind of depression come down that I have ever experienced. And so that's when I started realizing I had a problem. I had a major hospitalization in 2011 where I went into atrial fibrillation and my heart rate was over 200 beats a minute because I'd done too much meth.
You're fortunate to be alive.
I am fortunate to be alive. Now, that was in 2011 and my sobriety date's 2015. But I began pursuing sobriety at that point, checking it out. But I just, that idea of I've been able to kick everything else, I should be able to kick this, did not allow me to surrender myself to a program of recovery until Memorial Day weekend of 2015. I had been extraordinarily involved in a sobriety conference, which had been going on in Dallas. I was hosting a lot of the stuff, doing voiceover work, doing comedy for it. And I got it into my head that the only thing good about me was my ability to make people laugh. But I had absolutely no sexual appeal to anyone. And that sent me down a rabbit hole. And so I left this beautiful weekend of sobriety and proceeded to hook up with someone and get high on meth. And this time, the come down was the worst it had ever been. And within 5 days of stopping using, I attempted suicide. And that's not something I would do. But I realize in retrospect, I didn't want to die at that moment. I wanted this horrible lack of serotonin to stop. And that's the only way I knew how to make it stop. And fortunately, I was not successful. But I called a friend who took me to Presby. You use that S word. And you get put in the psych ward. And I spent 4 days in lockdown at Presbyterian Hospital. And I thought, you know, my 50th birthday party a few years ago was at the Meyerson Symphony Center with 125 of my nearest and dearest. What the hell am I doing in a psych ward? And it's where I had that moment of, I give up. And I had given up on the whole thing. Religion I'd been raised with too. I got tired of people telling me that God didn't love me because I was gay. So I went, okay, fine. So there, why bother with God? And it was in that moment that I just cried out to the ceiling. I can't do this. I need help. And the next day, about four things fell into place. I got into the rehab I wanted to go to. I found out I was going to get FMLA from my job. My insurance was going to pay 100% of my rehab. And I was able to reschedule an appearance that I was supposed to have in a couple of weeks with absolutely no problem. And that's when I said, okay, something or somebody heard me. Let's get to work.
No shit, Sherlock, man. There's no, that's not any, I don't believe in coincidences.
I don't either. And spending 45 days in rehab, I had nothing else to do but focus on my recovery. And I got into the 12-step work, and it changed my life. And during that process, I realized that I have so much fear in my life that I am scared of everything. And trying to allay those fears was inhuman and impossible to do. So I turned to crystal meth to quiet those fears.
There's another layer now. It was about shame, and now you've got the fear and
It's funny. I've talked about this, and one of my biggest fears when I was facing all of that in rehab, and it sounds so trivial, but I was afraid that whatever I did, you were going to roll your eyes at me. Oh, oh, Paul, please. Oh, Paul, don't you know you're not attractive? You tried, you think you're cute? Oh, my God. That kept me from being myself.
Paul, do you recall a time maybe at a young time in your life where somebody rolled their eyes at you like that? Because you're describing being triggered.
Mm-hmm.
You're describing a fear of something that's not happening in the moment, but it's something that's happened in the past, and you're thinking it's going to reoccur, recreate itself. I've been doing this long enough to know that's how that works. Do you have a conscious memory of a time early in your life when somebody rolled their eyes like that? And because that just, that is one of the most invalidating things that a person can do to another human being, is roll their eyes. And if it's a joke, that's one thing. If it's your friend and they're joking with you, that's one thing. But
there's two sides to this answer. I love the phrase that says that which annoys us most in others is often that which annoys us most in ourselves. And I, over my entire life, have rolled my eyes at so many people, places, and things. It's something I do without realizing it. Therefore, I can project that everyone else is going to do that to me.
Took the words right out of my mouth, that created projection.
Now, on the other side of that coin, there are two specific instances that are burned in my mind, both of which were related to a sexual hookup. One was, and they were both in the 90s, early to mid 90s. Well, the first one's not important. The second one, I was in another city. And a lot of times I had to, I felt like I needed to leave town to get laid because everyone in this town knew me. And it was like, oh, I can't have sex with you. I know you. Okay, whatever, So I'm out of town and I've hooked up with somebody. And we are in this person's house, and he invites two other people over. I'm thinking, oh, fine, party. And this was long before drugs. I had not even thought about doing drugs. And I'm sitting there, and I'm not wearing anything. And these two guys walk in the door. One of them took one look at me and went, ugh. And they turned around and walked out. And that is branded on my memory, such that I believe that that's how I'm seen by everybody else.
And then in turn, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Bingo.
Oh, Paul, I'm deeply sorry that you had to experience that, or that you did experience that.
Well,
there's no, that's so uncalled for. There's no excuse for that.
and I know now that that wasn't my issue. That was that person's issue. But all of these years I've been taking that on, and it has created a bunch of bricks made of fear. And so I have surrounded myself in a brick tower, and every brick is a different fear that I have. And I'm trapped. And I had a therapist one time say to me, "Paul, this is you when it comes to relationships. You're like, come closer. Whoops, come closer. But don't. I'll be goddamn if anyone is going to hurt me, because I've been hurt, and I will have the upper hand." But it's kept me trapped in that brick tower.
Mine's a fortress. Mine's not a brick tower. Mine's a fortress, and I've
Fair
spent
enough.
quite a few years in that. Most of my gay life. It's only been in the last couple of years that I have been able to dismantle that fortress and allow. I was always able to be authentic with my straight friends, but I couldn't be that way with gay men. It's only been in the last 2 or 2.5 years that I have been able to dismantle that fortress and now be myself with other gay men. Not all, it's just still discernment. You pick and choose who you feel are safe enough to lower your guard and let them see what I call the softer side of Sears.
I love that. Well, and here's the other thing. And that I don't know if this is unique to me or not, but I can be emotionally intimate at the drop of a hat. My three closest friends are my family of choice. All four of us are single. We share intimately with each other on an emotional level. We do not have physical intimacy.
I think I'm pretty sure I know who two of those are.
Probably. But I have no problem opening up. I told you this before we decided to do this podcast. I'm an open book, and I can share intimately with you, and I can receive your intimate sharing. But physical intimacy, we've got the problem of how I view myself. We've got the problem of the fear of what you're going to say or roll your eyes at me about. And then we've got the problem of childhood sexual trauma, where I have a fucked up attitude about sex in general. And that is, if I have sex with someone I know, it's not right, because that's how this got started in the first place.
Oh, you've got some wiring there you haven't been able to unwire yet. Yep, I get it. So this begs a question. Can be emotionally intimate, can't be physically intimate. You talked about your three closest friends, which are platonic relationships.
Right.
Are you able to be emotionally available and intimate with a non-platonic? Maybe the sex is over here, but if there was a love interest, somebody that was showing interest, can you do the emotional intimacy as well as you can with the platonic friends?
Well, not ever having had that opportunity, it's all hypothetical at this point. I had one relationship when I was 25, but we were each other's first, and it was very much a learning experience. So I wouldn't call it a functional relationship, but we were boyfriends, and we were monogamous. If there were someone that I had physical intimacy with which I was comfortable, then I feel like, yes, I could do the full circle, emotional and physical intimacy. But that has never presented itself. I often get answered, no, I often get asked the age-old question, have you ever been in love? And I don't know how to answer that because I don't know if I have. Now, I love my three closest friends, but it's not a full circle.
Yeah, that's different than in love. And I think that's a tough question for anybody, because how do you define love? I mean, it is the one thing in the universe that nobody's been able to sufficiently define. So how can we say, yes, I've been in love? I mean, I've been in a marriage to a woman and four serious relationships with men in my life. And I'm not sure I've had experienced what I would consider true love. It's been some facsimile thereof on some level, or that's my perception. I'm like, you know, my thing is, am I going to get to experience real love before I die? That's my question. I'm wondering if I'm going to get to experience what I think is the real healthy, integrated love that's not two halves making a whole, or it's not for all the wrong reasons. I can't stand to be alone, so I'm going to just pick the first person that comes by. There's so many reasons that we get in relationships that are not really real. They're for all the wrong reasons.
From where I sit listening to you, what you just said, I am in awe that you had four long-term relationships. Well, because what my brain says is, how did you get to that point?
Okay, it's all relative when you say long-term. It's, you know, in straight years, it was not long-term at all. In gay years, it was one relationship was 2 years long, one was 5 years long, one was 3 years long, and another one was 2 years long.
It was more than a weekend.
It was.
And the problem I have run into, I cannot tell you how many times I got to know somebody and I truly thought it was developing into a relationship. And I finally was the one who said, you know, where's this going? Oh, this is just a friendship. Oh, okay. So I've never been in that situation where you go, this is how it's supposed to feel. Because people that I was interested in never returned it. And if there were people that were interested in me, either I didn't see it or the chemistry was not there for me.
Yeah.
So to hear people, especially friends of mine who go from one relationship to the next, I'm like, what do you use for bait? You know, because.
Well, I can kind of speak to that. I think that it's not so much bait. It's that they're willing to just accept anybody that walks by. They're so not okay being alone, not okay being single or out a relationship, that they settle. They just grab the first thing that walks by. It's like, you're a warm body. You'll do.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Because as I said, I can think of maybe three places where there was someone interested in me and I didn't feel like it was the right one. And so I put the brakes on.
Well, I think that was you being true to you. As hard as that may have been, we all know what happens when we go ahead and we don't pay attention to the red flags or the signs or the intuition, and we go ahead and get into it. It almost always ends badly.
Well, and one of the things I learned in recovery, too, that I practice daily. If something doesn't work out, let it go. Man's rejection is God's protection. I have the retrospective to look back and see how that was true in numerous occasions.
I have never heard that. Man's rejection is God's protection. You know, I always say when somebody rejects you, they are doing you a favor. You just dodged a bullet.
Same thing.
Just dodged a bullet. Embrace rejection because it is the universe taking care of your ass.
Right. Because something out there, whether it's the universe or whatever you want to call God, is looking out and going,
When we get out of the way, I really believe the universe, whatever higher power you believe in, I call it universe a lot of the times. If we'll get out of the way, it will take care of us. I believe that with all my being. I get in the way sometimes.
And I fervently believe at this point in my life, I may be single to the day I die. And that's okay, because my life heretofore has been unbelievably amazing. So why should I complain?
Well, you didn't define your life by whether or not you had a relationship. And that's something we see a lot of. My life is nothing if I don't have a relationship. People think that it's going to be the all end all be all. A man's going to come into my life and suddenly everything's going to be rainbows and unicorns. It doesn't work that way for about 15 minutes.
Sure.
It may look that way for about 15 minutes. And then the proverbial shit hits the fan.
Well, my friend Jill, who was a fellow comedian, did this line that I thought was the most brilliant joke. She said, you know, when you get into a relationship and it's going really well and you move in together and you're in bed looking at him and watching him sleep, and you think to yourself, you're never going home, are you? And I swear to you, that would be, I feel like that would be my story. I got a boyfriend. Yeah. When are you going home?
Yep. Yep. I get it completely. Well, let's circle back for a minute. I love where we just went with that. That was a fun rabbit hole to go down. let's circle back. I would love to hear about the last 7 years, and we're kind of getting close to our hour, so I don't think we want to make it a really long story, but I would love to know, clean and sober, 7 years now, how's life different, and in what ways is life better?
Well, as I said, doing the step work, and for people who aren't in recovery, the 12 steps are an inventory you take of your life, basically, and actions that you take to clean up your past and move forward in a clean way. Part of that is looking back over your life at everything and everyone you've ever resented and figure out why and what your part in it was, and most importantly, what the fear is behind it.
Taking responsibility.
Sure. And yep. Then in cases where you can, going back and trying to clean that up and going to those people and making things right as best you can.
You know, I always say that it's a given as human beings that we're going to make messes. It's absolutely a given. But what the real question is not, are you going to make a mess? Yes, you're absolutely going to make a mess. Are you going to be a big enough human being to clean your mess up? Are you going to take responsibility and be a big enough human to clean your mess up? That's the real question.
And I think for me, doing that thorough look at my life was every bit as helpful as the years and years of therapy I've been in. It was a great addition to the therapy. But what I learned in that time of introspection, I've been able to let go of a lot of fears, not all of them. Obviously, I still am afraid of what you're going to think of me. And I'm still afraid to put myself out there, although I have more often since I got sober than I ever did before. I just feel like I know how to handle things better. You know, there's a saying in recovery that says we will intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle us. And I have lived that truth in the last 7 years.
Well, I think there's a legitimate concrete reason behind that. While I've not dealt with substance abuse in my own life to speak of, I mean, I had my days of drinking, but it was never a problem. Like it was only when there was a party. If there wasn't a party, I didn't have any interest in alcohol. But I know that when we start using substances on a regular basis and we get really in that, our emotional maturity is stunted. It stops. We don't grow emotionally. We don't emotionally mature when we're in substance abuse. And when we finally get clean and stop the substance abuse, we pick up with our emotional maturity wherever we left it back there. So if you started doing heavy drugs at 15 and now you're 40, you got 25 years of catching up to do to get to the, but what you're describing is you, when you stepped out of that, then your emotional maturity commenced. And what you just said completely validates that. You're capable. You've got the expanded emotional maturity to handle situations that you weren't able to handle prior to getting sober. I love that.
When I was a kid, my mother always said when I had a difficulty with something or things aren't going the way I want them to, blah, blah, blah. You know, her pat answer was bless it and release it. And I never understood that until after I did work on myself and became aware that I am completely powerless over other people. I can only have power over how I respond. I didn't cause the sun to rise. I have no power over that. What other people think of me is out of my power. If something happens, I can't go back and make it unhappen. And so you learn to accept and go, I can't do anything about this. How do we move forward?
You know, one of my favorite sayings about that are the people that matter don't care, and the people that care don't matter.
That's right.
And the ones that we're always most worried about are the ones that don't matter when you really step back and look at it. Because if they truly loved us and accepted us, they wouldn't care.
Right.
They wouldn't care.
And another place that I'm able to put in that, you know, bless it and release it thought process is before I finally got sober, during a 21-month period of sobriety, I became HIV positive. And as someone who came of age at the beginning of the AIDS crisis, I had always said that if this happens to me, I'm going to check out because I will not be able to deal with the shame. And I was raised to believe it was a death sentence. And so I made a mistake that resulted in a life-changing health something or other, as it were. And since I got sober, I'm able to accept the things the way they are. I can't go back and change it. I am in great health. I have a doctor who cares for me. And I have friends who are in the same boat who are a support to me. So don't get freaked out, Paul. Move forward.
Well, and you know, based on what you're telling me, Paul, you've really come a long way. I mean, I hear you say that you're afraid of what people are going to think, but you've just shared about childhood sexual abuse. You've shared about drug addiction. You've shared about HIV. And this is on a podcast that's going out for the entire world to hear. Now, not all the world will listen to it.
Oh, is it?
But it's out there. It's out there for the whole world to hear. And I just want to acknowledge you and reflect back to you the courage that I see in Paul J. to be able to do what you're doing in this conversation right now.
Thank you.
I want to reflect back the courage that I know it takes to do what you're doing right now, especially since you have a fear of what people are going to think and how they're going to judge you.
I love that saying that's been attributed to Marilyn Monroe, which is, if you can't accept me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best.
I think that's beautiful.
And I don't really want to self-sabotage, but I like to lay it out there so that you won't run away if you find out something.
If you're going to run away, let's find out you're going to run away right now, not a year from now, when I'm really invested. Yes. Exactly. Lay it all out on the table and get that out of the way right up front. I'm going to recount a story. This has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I just can't not tell this. I'll never forget. I don't know whether you were on stage or you may have been, or whether it was in one of our Turtle Creek Corral rehearsals, but you talked about, you know, sometime in your teenage years that you pinned a poster of Farrah Fawcett on the ceiling of your bedroom. And your mom and dad were kind of like, oh, you know, maybe he's not the sissy that we thought he was. You know, they were kind of excited. And then you said, and then I would lay in bed at night with the moonlight coming through the window and look up at that poster of Farrah Fawcett and think to myself, I wonder if I could make my hair do that. I have never forgotten that. I thought that was hysterical.
Oh, and it was so true. And actually, it was all three Charlie's Angels. And I always wanted Kate Jackson's haircut. And when I was a sophomore in high school, and I have the pictures to prove it, I got a Kate Jackson haircut.
Oh, my.
Such as it is.
Now, see, Farrah was my favorite. That fair hair. Oh, my gosh.
But I wasn't blonde, so I couldn't pull that off.
Well, I was never blonde either, but it was still the haircut itself was fabulous. She made herself famous with that. I mean, we still talk about the Farrah feathers. It's still a thing.
That's right.
And it's come back twice, I think, since the 70s when she made it popular. Okay. Well, one more question. Well, no, there's actually more, but one more question about this. And that is, in a brief sentence or two, what wisdom bomb would you drop on the listeners based on all the experiences that you've shared over the last hour? What's the one wisdom bomb that you'd like to bestow? Here's what I've been through and here's what I've learned.
Don't worry about it so much. Don't let fear get in your way, because here's the secret. Everybody else is just as scared as you are.
Amen. Amen. Some of us just hide it better than others.
And I'll tell you, that was a big truth for me. I fervently believed that I was a mess and everybody else in the world had their shit together. Yeah. And when I found out that was not the truth, and I found out by going to 12-step meetings and hear other people share their fears, and I'm like, you too?
Well, that's mainly what this podcast is about, Paul, allowing men to see that whatever they've got going on, that they're not alone. That somewhere in there's going to be a story told on this podcast that they're going to be able to relate to and realize I'm not alone.
And even the people that we may think are classically beautiful and have all of the trappings of the world, I guarantee you that person is scared of something.
that comes with a whole set of problems all on its own.
Yeah.
Whole set of problems. Well, that was an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing it. And I love that wisdom bomb that you just dropped. I hope that the listeners really took that in and really got it, because it was spot on, in my opinion.
Thank you.
So let's move into our rapid fire questions. Now, one of them you answered already, but I think I'm going to ask it anyway. I'm going to ask it just a little bit differently. The first question is, what are you most afraid of? And you talked about what you've been afraid of in the past. I guess I'm going to reference the question or rephrase the question now. Now, in 7 years of sobriety and letting go of a lot of those old fears that you had drug around for a long time, is there something new, or what would be maybe the one thing that you're most afraid of now, present tense, that you'd like to transform the way you've transformed some of these older fears?
I am afraid of getting to the point in my life where I don't have an outlet for my creativity. You know, I don't want to become physically unable to do things. You know, I don't want to be a boring legal secretary and that's it. I still want to have places to be. On stage, nothing brings me greater joy than to make people laugh. And I've given that gift.
Paul, I'm going to ask you a question that somebody asked me one time that really changed the way I saw things. Is it anywhere in your nature to be a boring legal secretary?
Well, I'm good at it. Let's put it that way.
Yes, but that's not what I ask.
but that is a fear. What if I become that person?
I don't, you know, can your humor ever be taken away from you? And if what point it's taken away from you, will you care beyond that?
Yeah, good point.
You know, humor is something that we can have right up to our last breath unless we can't speak. And even then, sometimes just the way we move our eyes can be humorous if we're around people that know what that means.
Yeah.
I think that it is in your nature to be a funny person. And I don't think that there's any way you cannot be that funny person, regardless of what you're doing on the side hustle or the day job or whatever, however you refer to that, you know? You're a comedian at heart. You have been your entire life. That's your nature.
It's on my license plates. Funny one.
Yes.
You ever see that license plate, you know it's me. Well, so that's
it's your
places of ill repute.
It's your email address as well. Doesn't your email address have
my email address? Yeah, PJ yes. Funny one.
Yes. Okay. Second question. If you could go back in time and say anything to the younger Paul, what would you tell him? Any time in his life, your choice.
Oh, there's so many places. Your dad doesn't know as much as you think he does, so don't let him get to you.
Perfect. I love it, because I know there's men out here that are hearing that right now that need to hear that.
I gave my father way too much power.
He's not God. He's dad.
He's not God.
He's God.
Human.
He's human. His shit stinks just like everybody else.
Hello.
Yeah. And final question. Many years from now, you're a ghost at your own funeral. And in those first two or three pews are all of your bestie gay men friends. What do you hope that they're saying about you in the midst of your funeral?
That there will never be another person like Paul. And we will always have the laughter and or I'm so lucky that I got to know inside of who he is.
I love that. That's beautiful. Paul, I got little cold chills running up and down me right now. That's beautiful. Wow. Well, this has been amazing. I just want to say thank you so much for opening your heart and sharing your story and being so forthright and so transparent, and especially after describing, you know, the fears of what people are going to think and how they might judge. Just once again, just want to acknowledge you. This is huge.
Well, and thank you for doing this, because, you know, this, we don't know how our story may be able to help another, and you facilitate that. And that's a blessing.
We don't often get to see the ripples, the ripple effect of our story, but I can tell you that it does ripple, because I get comments every day from a listener that says, wow, that story impacted me so much. Thank you so much for, you know, being the vessel for this.
Sure.
So, Paul, it's been an honor and a pleasure.
Likewise.